know, we have a concurrent session going on prospects for peace in the Middle East, so I expect that there might be a little bit of session hopping. So just I'd ask that if you leave in the middle to please do it as quietly as possible. Well, I'm delighted to be able to chair this extraordinarily well-placed group of panelists. We have drawn them from government, think tank, and academic media worlds, and I think we're indeed more than well covered to tackle the extremely timely but extraordinarily complicated topic that we have before us today. Given that we've got a rather tight schedule, I'm going to resist any temptation I might have to give any opening remarks, and I'm just going to raise three broad questions and move quickly on to the panelists. These three questions, I think, are critical to understanding prospects for peace in South Asia. The first one would be relating to the broad area of U.S. policy. For the first time, the U.S. has good relations with both India and Pakistan, and it seems to me that there are both potentialities as well as perils in this unique position, both for the U.S. and for the actors in the region. The second cluster of questions would be on Indo-Pakistan relations, and the question of what will it take for India and Pakistan to resume their dialogue, what will it take for India to regain really trust with Pakistan, and what will be the effect of domestic politics within these countries on the outcome. And finally, the third question would be, I think, militancy and religious violence in the region. What is the future of Islamic militancy in South Asia, especially in the context of the war on terrorism? What is the future of political violence generally in the region? And there has been, of course, a lot of activity on related to Kashmir recently, especially the second track engagement with the India and the Kashmiri militants. What does this all add up to? Well, let me now turn to our panelists who hopefully will touch on some of these issues. And what I will do is introduce all the speakers at once, and then after they have finished their presentations, we will have a question and answer session. So please hold your questions until all of the speakers have completed their talks. We'll start with Christina Rocca, who this afternoon is fortunate to be here since there was no crisis that erupted, as far as I can tell, this morning. We're always a little concerned when we have people who are actually decision-making powers as a presenter. Ms. Rocca is the key point person on South Asia in the State Department. Prior to her current appointment, she was the Foreign Affairs Advisor to Senator Sam Brownback, and she was the author of several very important legislation relating to South Asia. Our second speaker is Strobe Talbot, who's currently the president of the Brookings Institution. After a long and illustrious career spanning journalism, government, and most recently academia at Yale, Mr. Talbot was, of course, the Deputy Secretary of State under the Clinton administration, during which time he was a very highly visible figure on the subcontinent, especially on Indo-US relations. Our third speaker is Nayan Chanda, presently the Director of Publications at the Center for the Study of Globalization at Yale. Mr. Chanda is probably best known for his time as the editor-at-large for the Far Eastern Economic Review, where many of us have read his always thoughtful and incisive pieces. I'm going to ask that our speakers please limit the talk to about 15 minutes so we'll have enough time to engage in discussion. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me to be here today to talk about essentially what I do all day. You heard this morning about Afghanistan, so I will limit my comments to that, but I did want to point out that we did have a minor crisis, maybe not so minor, this morning in Afghanistan as well. So there's a crisis a day. This subject, the topic of the prospects for peace in South Asia, is central to the goals of the United States and the interests of the international community in the region. I know that a principal concern of this gathering today is the continuing crisis between India and Pakistan. But I'd also like to review the current administration, and I will review the current administration on this thinking, but it's also important to keep in mind that there are other quite serious conflicts in South Asia. I think these also need to be included in any discussion of stability and the prospects for peace. I know that the situation in Afghanistan was taken up at the separate section this morning, but I'd also like to talk about Sri Lanka, where there are some indications that an almost 20-year conflict may be on the way to resolution, and about Nepal, where a rural insurgency has grown over the last 5 years to threaten the future of a country struggling to establish prosperity and democracy. Throughout South Asia, the search for prosperity and democracy are too often overshadowed by the specter of war. The most prominent case in the region, of course, is the continuing crisis between India and Pakistan. Twice so far this year, the possibility of war between India and Pakistan has been very real. Hundreds of thousands of Indian and Pakistani troops were mobilized along the border and along the line of control. These crises were generated by extremely provocative terrorist acts, first against the Indian Parliament in New Delhi last December, and then against families of Indian soldiers in Jammu in May. The forces of extremism once again sought to exploit the deep and long-standing differences between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. They didn't succeed, and the tensions have been reduced since then, thanks to the decisions made in Islamabad and New Delhi with the encouragement of the international community. But we and the rest of the international community remain deeply concerned. The military mobilization continues. The rhetoric, though muted, could bubble up again. And another major terrorist attack or a significant surge in violence could still spark a military confrontation with long-standing and devastating consequences for the entire region. The enemies of moderation in the region are aware of this fact and have already tried to exploit it through high-profile terrorist attacks, and they could very well try again. We need to recognize that an important factor in this current crisis is the willingness of extremists and terrorists to go to any length to reach their goals. Our efforts to prevent conflict between India and Pakistan are made even more urgent by the global war on terrorism. President Musharraf, recognizing the danger that extremism poses to his country, has denounced the senseless ideology of violence. Pakistani authorities have moved against extremist groups. The extremists, showing how threatened they feel by President Musharraf, have struck back. The government has not been intimidated. Instead, it's continued its campaign against terrorists and their supporters, and was by standing by Pakistan as it faces this brutal challenge. Secretary Powell has said that war is just not an option in resolving differences between India and Pakistan. It will only make the situation worse, probably much worse. The only realistic way forward is the path of dialogue and confidence building. The Secretary has also publicly recognized that Kashmir is now on the international agenda. Given the potential cost of a conflict, the international community has focused on the need to reduce tension and to demobilize. No one from the outside can impose a settlement, but we must work to help the two sides further de-escalate current tensions and begin to tackle the more fundamental differences that separate them. Both sides have reaffirmed their desire for a peaceful political solution to their differences. President Musharraf has pledged that his government will provide no support for infiltration across the line of control, and that he will not permit Pakistan to be used as a base for terrorist attacks in any other country. Pakistan needs to sustain that pledge in order to begin a process of resolution of the immediate crisis and of its more fundamental differences with India. We also look to India to take further de-escalatory actions as Pakistan carries through with its commitments. As tensions begin to subside, New Delhi should agree to resume talks with Islamabad on all issues, including Kashmir. During his recent meetings with Indian leaders in New Delhi, Secretary Powell saw that there was solid commitment for dialogue, and he said that India understands that their dialogue had to include all the issues between the two nations, but especially it had to include Kashmir. The problems of Kashmir cannot be resolved through violence, but only through a healthy political process and dialogue between the parties. And we look forward to free and fair elections in Kashmir beginning later this month. We also encourage a continuation and expansion of nascent efforts to engage Kashmiri separatist leaders. Kashmiris, Pakistanis, and Indians must do their part to ensure that the upcoming elections can be held in safety and without interference from those who would like to spoil them. Recent attacks on officials and political party activists in Kashmir cannot be allowed to derail the election. State elections can be an important step in a political process, but they alone cannot resolve the problems between India and Pakistan, nor can they erase the scars of so many years of strife. Only a productive and sustained bilateral dialogue on all issues will prevent further crisis and finally bring peace to the region. We're committed to staying engaged in the months and years ahead, helping both parties resolve their differences so that everyone in the region can live in dignity, prosperity, and security. As I mentioned earlier, there are serious conflicts in South Asia in which thousands have died, and thousands more can die if they're not resolved. And I'll touch briefly on the situations in Sri Lanka and Nepal. I hope that our discussions after the opening remark will include some attention to these serious situations. Recent developments in Sri Lanka have been encouraging and give us a cause for cautious optimism. After almost two decades of war, costing well over 60,000 lives, a serious peace process is now underway. A ceasefire has been in place since last year. Norway, which has been acting as a facilitator, recently announced that the Sri Lankan government and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam have agreed to begin the first round of formal talks on September 16th in Thailand. The government's announcement yesterday that it was lifting the ban on the Tamil Tigers as part of the peace process is another very welcome development. The U.S. has supported Norway's efforts, and we are continuing to watch developments very closely. We hope that the talks will eventually bring an end to this bitter conflict. The Norwegian government has played a key role in bringing the two sides together in what appears to be a major step forward. We wish them and the Sri Lankan parties continued success in their effort towards peace. A negotiated political settlement to this conflict would be the best demonstration that negotiation, not violence, provides the most effective means for dealing with contentious issues that divide and separate peoples throughout the world. And we believe that such a settlement is possible if both parties continue to demonstrate the constructive and serious approach that has brought the process to this point. The people of Sri Lanka deserve nothing less. Everyone should understand, however, that the path to peace will not be smooth, and this is just the first step on the journey. The United States strongly supports the Sri Lankan peace process, as the President affirmed in July when he met with the Sri Lankan Prime Minister in Washington. Deputy Secretary of State Armitage recently concluded a successful visit to Sri Lanka, which included meetings with the government, the opposition, and the Tamil leaders. He referred to this during his speech at lunch. And he emphasized that the U.S. commitment to peace in Sri Lanka and our desire to help that country realize its great potential. We'll continue to urge a negotiated settlement which has as its goal a nation that is whole, at peace, and respects the rights of all its citizens. I wish we could have as much optimism over an early end to the conflict in Nepal. That country continues to confront a violent Maoist insurgency, now in its sixth year, which has left over 4,000 dead. The Maoists have employed ruthless tactics in the field and conducted terrorist attacks against both government targets and innocent civilians. We acknowledge the Nepal government's right and duty to protect its citizens within the framework of the Constitution. Unfortunately, Nepal's ruling political party is locked in a power struggle that inhibits the government's effectiveness in dealing with the insurgents and undertaking development initiatives to start restoring its authority in the countryside. The U.S. is finalizing plans for assistance as part of an international response to end this brutal conflict and help bring peace to Nepal. Our programs are intended to facilitate the government's efforts both to restore security and to focus on development and poverty reduction. To truly end this conflict, the government and the people of Nepal must build a better future for their country and their people. Nepalese must hold their officials accountable for good governance and ending corruption. All must work to find the common ground on which to begin rebuilding what the Maoists have destroyed. We can assist in that reconstruction by continuing to aid Nepal's economic development. Peace can provide the space in which Nepal can diversify its economy, attract foreign investment, and seek sustainable and environmentally sound ways to tap the potential of its natural resources, which, while much remains to be done, many in the international community stand ready to assist. These are then the three of the four major conflicts in South Asia. All need to be resolved to have true peace in the region. It's our intent that the United States does what it can to move towards resolution of each one. As Secretary Powell said in his visit in the region to the region in July, what the United States is trying to do is to play the role of a friend, a good friend to all the nations of South Asia. He observed that our relations with all the nations in the region are perhaps better than at any time in the last quarter century, and he noted that if we're seen as a good partner, then we can be in a position to perhaps assist nations in resolving their differences. Not as a meddler or as a mediator, but somebody whose good offices can help bring people to the table to deal with their differences. We hope that we'll be able to play this role in the region. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for including me on this program. I'd like to begin by paying Christina two compliments. First, for reminding us, not that everybody in this room needed reminding, that there are more countries in South Asia than just India and Pakistan. Both the Indians and the Pakistanis often complain that they're so often linked by a hyphen in the way that Americans think and talk about them. But the problem goes deeper and broader than that, in that many Americans forget that there are these other extremely wrenching and vexing and dangerous problems in South Asia. And not only has she called attention to those, but she's given some indication of the intensity of American diplomacy with regard to those other issues. And that leads me to the second compliment that I want to pay her, and that is for being not just a part of the team, but the full-time member of the team in the Bush administration that has carried out, I think, some extremely successful and promising diplomacy in South Asia. And that team, of course, has been led by Secretary Powell and also by Rich Armitage, who addressed you at lunch today. I think that it's really quite extraordinary that the administration has been able to resist or overcome what is one of the great perils of trying to conduct diplomacy in South Asia, and that is having the U.S. in some way get drawn into the zero-sum dynamic between India and Pakistan, and doing that in the wake of September 11th, when Pakistan shot up to near the top of the list of countries of great importance strategically to the United States, and giving the appropriate emphasis and importance to Pakistan while not paying a price in the good relations that have developed with India in recent years is a terrific compliment, and I hope you'll pass that on when you get back to the office this afternoon, Christina.
Thank you.
What I thought I would do, for a couple of reasons, is zero in on a topic that has preoccupied a number of us in this room as I look around and see some old friends and colleagues, Jim Goodby being one of many, think about how much of our careers we have spent or misspent on the subject of arms control. It's kind of interesting that that topic has fallen off the agenda generally, and certainly with regard to South Asia. And I'd like, at least for the purposes of my brief remarks, to put it back on the agenda. The topic of the conference, or this portion of the conference, of course, is the prospects for peace in South Asia. And that's an issue that has more than a little bit to do with whether the nuclear weapons which are accumulating there are ever used in anger. I remember as a very young person hearing from my father, who was at the time, this was in the early 50s, reading Arnold Toynbee's History of Civilization, that Toynbee had predicted that World War III would begin in the Vale of Kashmir. Well, maybe the reference to World War III has a sort of antiquated tone to it, but the danger that he was speaking of and the root cause, of course, is all too contemporary, and I think Nyan, no doubt, will pick up on the political context. But I would like just to recall for you a little bit the history of the last 4 or 5 years with regard to the nuclear issue, and pass along to Christina and her colleagues what I intend to be a constructive thought for the future. All of you remember, of course, the sequence of events that began with the Indian government's decision to test nuclear weapons in the Pokhran Desert in May of 1998. And then, of course, Pakistan followed suit very soon, about 2 weeks thereafter. The United States threw itself into very intense diplomacy for the next couple of years with what was in many ways a very modest objective, although it turned out to be unachievable in some respects that I will touch on in a minute. What, of course, many of us would have liked to have done would have been to, as the cliche would have it, put the genie back into the bottle. But that simply wasn't on. First of all, there was no way that the two governments, India and Pakistan, were going to either untest the weapons that they had already tested, nor did they have any intention, having tested those weapons, to then somehow put themselves right with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So the objective of both of the dialogues that the United States carried out during that period with India and with Pakistan was confined to five so-called benchmark issues. And I'm going to tick them off for you, and then I'm going to sort of refer to how we stand on those issues today. The first has a particularly melancholy ring to it, and that was to get India and Pakistan to sign up to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Second was to breathe a new life and have a breakthrough of some kind in the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty and the negotiations which were then underway in Geneva. Third was the issue of export controls, which is to say having both countries undertake world-class standards in ensuring that dangerous technology and know-how, and I stress know-how because human proliferation was as much a problem as proliferation of actual dangerous materials to countries of concern, so-called. Fourth was a question, was an issue that we never even entirely agreed on the terminology for. At one point, we called it strategic restraint, a term that the Indian side didn't care for particularly. But the basic notion was to bring the danger of an all-out destabilizing and very dangerous arms race between India and Pakistan under control by having both sides exercise a high degree of restraint over the nature, the number, the disposition, and, of course, the deployment of their weapon systems, and that meant especially their ballistic missile systems. And then fifth on the list of benchmarks was the question of the India-Pakistan dialogue, which, of course, at some points was a euphemism for defusing the India-Pakistan conflict or crisis. Well, here we are in 2002, more than 4 years later, and it is a little bit sobering to look back at that original list and see not only what progress has been made, but on which issues there's any hope of progress today. I would suggest that really only numbers 3 and 5 on that list seem to be operative, including in the sense of being high on the agenda of U.S. diplomacy. 3 and 5 being export controls, which remains very much a concern, quite properly, of the Bush administration. And 5, of course, is the India-Pakistan dialogue, which has engaged, to good effect, so much of the energy of Christina, as well as Colin Powell and Rich Armitage. Number 1 on the original list, the CTPT, is, as we say in Washington, OBE, since the United States Senate acted on the misbegotten notion that that treaty was fatally flawed. However, it's an important parenthesis. As best I understand, the Bush administration feels strongly that it would be a mistake for India and Pakistan to test additional, to carry out additional tests of nuclear weaponry, and so far that hasn't happened, so that is some consolation. As for number 2 on the list, the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, that's one that got the least attention at the time and gets virtually no attention now, largely because it's highly technical, but it's actually quite an important issue. And it seems to have either petered out as an issue of concern, maybe Christina can correct me on that, or at least gone very much onto the back burner. Now, the Indian side, during the dialogue that we had back in the latter half of 98 and into 99, took the position that they weren't saying no, never to the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, but they were saying not now, and they suggested on a couple of occasions that they needed a couple of years, that was the phrase that we heard sometime, a couple of years in order to manufacture enough fissile material for them to feel strategically comfortable signing the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty. Well, guess what? A couple of years have gone by So I think a logical question that now arises is, have their needs changed, or isn't there now perhaps a more compelling case for signing up or closing off those negotiations and having a breakthrough? And that, of course, goes to the fourth issue on the original list, which is the question of strategic restraint. And there, I think that there has been both very little progress with regard to both of those countries, India, Pakistan, and not, as far as I can tell, a whole lot of attention or effort on the part of the United States. There is still, perhaps in the case of some spokesmen in India and Pakistan, sincerity here, perhaps in the case of others, lip service. But there's a lot of talk about how India and Pakistan rely on minimal deterrence, existential deterrence, and yet when you look at the actual military programs, they seem to go well beyond anything that would qualify as minimal deterrence. I would suggest, with all due respect to the individual in question, that it's of some sobering significance that Abdul Kalam, the father of the Indian missile program, and a very prominent player in the development of the nuclear weapons program in that country, is the president of India today. And as for specific weapon systems, the Agni missile, which was originally explained to us and others as being primarily for sort of demonstration purposes to send a particular signal to the Chinese, and there was a lot of talk about the China contingency when the Agni was discussed, has now been inducted into the force in India as a missile for shorter range contingencies, presumably ones prominently including Pakistan. And meanwhile, of course, Pakistan has by no stretch of the imagination been asleep at the switch. Their programs have been going forward as well. Now, I'll wrap this up and then we can come back to it in the discussion, but where I would suggest this might come out in a constructive vein would be the following. I think that precisely because the relationship between the United States and both India and Pakistan is so very good now, and because the Bush administration has done a very laudable job in building on the fairly basic improvement in relations that occurred in the last couple of years of the previous administration, there is an opportunity for the Bush administration to put these issues, particularly the issues of strategic restraint and the fissile material cutoff treaty, back onto the agenda, perhaps in a quiet way. Maybe that's what it'll take to make it effective and successful, but both with the Indians and the Pakistanis. Now, I realize that doing so requires great sensitivity because it always carries with it the risk that the two countries in question will say that this constitutes interference in their sovereign rights. And I know the Indians have been particularly sensitive on that point in talking to us. But I would modestly suggest that shouldn't stop us from doing so. After all, it's going to require even more sensitivity and at the same time resolve in order for us to play a constructive, us the United States to play a constructive role on another question, which is also one of great sensitivity, especially with the Indians. And that's the one that goes to number 5 on the original list, the India-Pakistan dialogue, and it also goes to the topic that I think Nayan will be speaking about now, which is Kashmir. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to be with this panelist this afternoon and be at U.S. Institute for Peace event this afternoon. I returned from India last week, and with the idea that the old cliche that crisis also brings opportunity may not be cliche after all. I come back from India with a little more optimism about Kashmir than I had any time in the past. September 11 has been like a bolt of lightning, which has not only illuminated a very marquee scene of terrorism that has grown in South Asia, Southwest Asia, over the years, and especially on Kashmir, which has been bearing the brunt of terrorism for a number of years without being much noticed by the world outside. While the light of the lightning has illuminated the issues, the heat has also forged a new alliance between the US and Pakistan, which actually is helpful in bringing about a solution to Kashmir. Now, I just would like to look at the players and see what changes I see in their positions on Kashmir. First of all, Pakistan. Pakistan has long maintained that it supports the Kashmiri militants politically, militarily, politically, diplomatically, and morally. But for the first time, as a result of the intense pressure put on Pakistan by the United States and other countries, and by India in the wake of attack on the Indian Parliament in December 12, General Musharraf took a very dramatic step in announcing, I quote him, "No organization will be allowed to indulge in terrorism in the name of Kashmir." This is the first ever admission that Pakistan was perhaps helping terrorism in Kashmir by saying it will not do it again. And second, of course, was that speech, while it was hailed by everybody in course of the ensuing few months, kind of petered out. The five terrorist organizations in Kashmir, Pakistan, which were banned, their supporters and members reorganized themselves under different names, and about 2,000 militants who were arrested, they were mostly released quietly. And then, of course, came the attack on Indian soldiers' families that Christina mentioned in April, leading to a new crisis and the threat of nuclear war, and India mobilized its troops. In the light of those developments, then President Musharraf gave a second commitment to Secretary Armitage, saying that Pakistan would end infiltration permanently and also would work towards closing down the training camps, militant training camps that were in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. So from criticizing, from indicting terrorism, to second step was to promise that there will be no infiltration. And that, again, has had mixed success. By the end of August, the reports were that infiltration was up again from the level of June, and activities by the militants in Kashmir, especially attacking political leaders, has picked up. And Secretary Armitage was in Pakistan again, and this time there was a further new commitment by General Musharraf, as Secretary Armitage told PBS. He said, "President Musharraf told me that his government's position was to condemn violence during any electoral season." That Musharraf would say that there will be no violence against election again was a new step, because only a few days earlier, Musharraf in a speech has called the elections in Kashmir as a farce. But now to say that it was against violence during electoral season was a new step. But most interesting is the report in the Pakistani newspaper, the News, which is the Jung newspaper. On September 1, the newspaper reported that Musharraf is considering a bargain that provided for recognition by both sides of the line of control as a permanent border, withdrawal of India's widely asserted claim on Azad Kashmir and northern areas, and as a consequence, Islamabad's agreement to make it clear to Kashmiri groups that holding elections in Indian-held Kashmir was an internal issue of the country. Now, this is, of course, a revolutionary change if it were true. And, in fact, just before this meeting, I had asked Ms. Roca whether she had any confirmation of that, and she said she didn't, but she will perhaps elaborate on this issue. But acceptance by Pakistan of line of control as a permanent border has been the goal to which I think the United States administration has been very favorable to, as well as Indians have been asking for it as a way of solving the issue by accepting the division of Kashmir as it is since 1947. Now, there's also change in the situation in Kashmir itself. The 9/11 made it appear to everybody who looked at the TV that after that event, carrying on terrorist attack on civilian targets could no longer be presented to the world as a struggle for freedom in Kashmir, and that the violence, use of violence as a political means, was going to be very dimly viewed by those who earlier supported Kashmiri struggle. Kashmiri population itself is absolutely fatigued by the violence, which has taken more than 30,000 lives, and Kashmiri separatist groups who have in the past toyed with the idea of militant action has become much more concerned about losing their say in the settlement if Pakistan takes the lead in dealing with India. So I think there is a new tension developing between Pakistan and the militant groups, separatist groups in Kashmir, one of the results of which has been the murder of a moderate leader, Abdul Ghani Lone, in Kashmir in a few months earlier. So Kashmiri militant groups, too, are now keen to actually talk to India, and in fact they have indicated in private conversations that they are willing to take part in the elections if India government assured them that elections were not to legitimize the current Abdullah government, but to prepare the stage for negotiations for autonomy. And there I come to Indian situation. Indian position has also changed in the last 2 years. Mr. Vajpayee, the Prime Minister, has, in a widely publicized rumination, has said that India needs to move ahead, leaving the historical baggage. And in his national address on 15th August, he said that, "I wish to assure the people of Jammu and Kashmir that if any mistakes have occurred, we shall make amends. For this, we shall talk to the elected representatives and organizations. Discussions will also take place on the demand for more powers to the state." This is, again, the first time that an Indian prime minister has admitted that there are amends to be made in Kashmir and that the government will talk to the people further beyond the election for more powers to the state. Now, and finally, the United States position too has changed, which of course is very subtle in the sense that the United States has said, I'm referring to Secretary Christina Roca's testimony to the Congress, in which she was asked whether the United States supported the UN resolution for plebiscite in Kashmir, and he referred to the 72 agreement between India and Pakistan, in which LOC was considered to be a permanent border, that idea was mooted. So she indirectly said that that was the case, that United States was no longer pursuing the idea of plebiscite, which has been an article of faith as in the Pakistani position so far. But more importantly, I think despite India's aversion to international interference in Kashmir, Indian and Pakistanis both have welcomed the role the United States has played, and there is no protest that United States diplomats are going to Kashmir to talk to separatist groups urging them to take part in elections. And the and Secretary Powell's remarks in Delhi, in which he called for a free and fair and inclusive election, has not elicited any strong response as an interference. So in the United States, because of its very privileged position with Kashmir, with Pakistan and with India both, are in a position really to push towards the settlement, and the ground, I think, is much more propitious today than any time in the past. Now, more concretely, what needs to be done? It is clear that both Indians and Pakistanis realize that military solution is not on. Kashmir cannot be solved militarily. And yet, how does one arrive at a situation when there can be political dialogue is the issue. And there is a question, of course, of General Musharraf's own internal problem dealing with militants who are opposed to his making these concessions to India. And India's ruling BJP party also is split, where the Deputy Prime Minister Adbani is a more hardline person than Mr. Vajpayee. Now, to very quickly tick off some of the things that steps can be taken, and that applies to all parties concerned. First of all, United States does need to keep the pressure on General Musharraf to keep his promise of stopping infiltration permanently and to accept the excuse that he doesn't control all the militants would actually be the proverbial equivalent of allowing a camel's nose into the tent. Second, United States could urge Musharraf to actually accept line of control as the de facto border, pending a political solution, which would obviously involve autonomy, a full autonomy on both sides of Kashmir. Third, hold General Musharraf to his private promise that he won't encourage violence against elections in Kashmir, because although the infiltration has been reduced, Pakistani influence over the militant groups still remain pretty strong, and there has to be a message from Pakistan that killing political candidates in elections is not going to be helpful. Fourth, India should be urged to do the following things. The four things India needs to do. First, establish a governance rule in Kashmir so that elections can be held in a more impartial condition and not have the Farooq government holding the elections and damaging its credibility. Second, only once that has been done can Kashmir government can be urged to release political activists who have had very minor charges against them to create a condition more propitious for a free election. Thirdly, abolish the special protection group, a paramilitary group that has been set up, which actually has been acting as a force of extortion and repression rather than providing security, should be abolished, again, to create a better atmosphere. And finally, assure Kashmiri population and the militant groups that prelude to serious dialogue is the election, because election would help select the people's representatives with whom New Delhi can talk. And there is some positive development in that score, because for the first time, again, the militant groups, one of them actually arrived in Delhi last week, spent the week talking to different political parties and Defense Minister George Fernandez. And tomorrow, all-party Hurriyat conference, the biggest umbrella organization, actually is going to arrive in Delhi for talks. These are rather positive developments, and I hope that with the proper prodding of the United States, these moves can go forward. Thank you.